Our last half hour of the Bill Mahler Show on 720 WGN. We'll talk it up till 3 o'clock, and then we'll hand it over to Andy Mazur and Glenn Kozlowski for Sports Central today. You're about to hear a remarkable story about victims of the Holocaust, but in a most uncommon way. The story is told in the book Sitting on Top of the World. It's by Steve Richards. The story of a couple of German brothers whose family was torn apart by World War I. One grew up Jewish and ends up in a concentration camp. The other leads a wholly different life. Their father was a member of the Nazi brown shirts. I can tell you the story, but I'd rather have the man who tells it so expertly in his book, Steve Richards. Good to have you in the Allstate Showcase studio, Steve.
Well, thank you very much for having me here today.
All right, let's pick it up. How did this come to you? There's a lot of serendipity and unexpected encounters to start it off.
Yeah, a friend of mine in 2000, 2001 told me a little bit about the story. And quite candidly, he didn't know that much about the story. He was telling me the story about his father. And in essence, what the hook was for me was that my friend is Jewish, that his grandfather was a Nazi brown shirt, and there was a disconnect. Well, how could that factually be? You can't have that happen.
Now, the brown shirts were this sort of paramilitary wing that would become under the wing of this ruthless psychopath, Ernst Röhm.
Yes.
And they were super Nazis, in a way.
Yes, these were a lot of psychopaths. These are the true zealots that put a fist behind the word. And so these are very dangerous people.
So a Jewish guy saying that the father was a brown shirt. I mean, it just doesn't connect.
And that's what happened with me. And I tried to ask my friend questions, and he knew certain things, but he didn't know a lot. And that sort of laid around for a number of years until I decided to go ahead and do it.
So how did you piece the full story together? What kind of research did you do?
Well, I spent probably 5,000 hours beginning in 2008 working on this project over 7 years. And it started with simply sitting down with Kurt Wagner, who's the main person in the book, along with his brother, and asking him questions. And it was
And Kurt is in Chicago today.
Yeah, he's in a suburb of Chicago. He's a terrific guy. And I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with him. And I will tell you, at least for me, somebody who's not an experienced author at that time, to sit down and ask somebody who I knew very peripherally, very invasive, very personal questions was uncomfortable for both of us. But it worked out, and we became friends.
So your interest, why don't we first tell about the story?
Sure.
Give us sort of the thumbnail as to how these brothers grew up, how they became separated, and what happened on their separate tracks.
All right. It's a very complicated set of facts, but the short version is that in 1930, and I define them this way because it's easier, the Christian German brother was born. And he was born after the parents married 14 days before his birth. And so you have an Orthodox Jewish mother and a Protestant father. They marry. 14 days later, the older brother is born. 14 months later, Kurt, the person I know, was born. And an agreement was fashioned, and it's remarkable. The father at that time was not, the biological father was not a Nazi brown shirt. He was just a bad guy. And the agreement that was fashioned, in essence, said, we're going to take the older brother at the time of the birth of the younger brother, and he's going to live with the paternal Christian grandparents in this town called Karlsruhe. And shortly after that, Kurt went to live with the maternal Orthodox Jewish family in the same town. And they lived next door to each other for essentially 10 years, never knowing of each other.
Gosh.
The Christian brother never meeting his mother, at least he thought.
Didn't the guys ask a parent?
They absolutely did. And the resounding answer was throughout the entire story, we're not talking about it. And what ends up happening is that Kurt is deported in October 22nd, 1940, to a camp system that I was not aware of, and very few people, I think, are aware of, called Camp de Gurs in the southwestern part of France near the Pyrenees Mountains. And there began a Holocaust experience before he emigrated to the United States.
Camp de Gurs, now is that camp of war?
No, that Gurs was the name of the town.
Oh, okay, because de Gurs is
it's G-U-R-S.
Okay.
And Kurt eventually, through the aid of the Quakers, came to the United States, where he had a different life that began here in the city of Chicago.
And the other brother?
The other brother remained in Germany. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2007, and he lived and died in the exact same
town. So during the war, or during the years like from 1933 forward, when Hitler started his campaign, the war didn't start till September 1st of 39. What was their experience growing up during the fighting?
Well, Kurt leaves for the United States in July of 42. He eventually leaves Camp de Gurs for a place called Maison des Papelles, and it's high up in the Pyrenees Mountains, essentially a safe house. And through the aid of the Quakers, he leaves and goes to the United States. He is, for all intents and purposes, not touched by the war in terms of being in actual harm's way.
So, but he's Jewish. Wouldn't, by 42, he have been singled out somehow?
Well, the 50 children were taken from the camp through the aid of the Quakers, and they were placed in a safe house. And so the Nazis were not there looking for them. This is a former tuberculosis sanitarium, so it was just a bunch of kids there. So they were safe until, as I said, the Quakers got them out in 42. By 43, Karlsruhe is a bombed-out city. There's nothing left, and Heinz now lives in a different world. That's the Christian brother, in terms of seeing the death and destruction that befell him, his city, and his father, too, who also passed away that year in 43.
What about the coming together of the brothers?
That did not physically happen until the late 70s, when Kurt, to my surprise, after learning many things, through an informal contact, was requested to go back to Germany. And he swore he would never go back to Germany. And he, in fact, went back to Germany with his two sons and met for the very first time his brother.
So So it was the brother in Germany that identified him, it sounds like.
Well, through in 1946, the Red Cross, just on the eve of Kurt's adoption, was able to locate the brother. And he wrote a letter to Kurt. And one of the very sad things within this book is that letter was hidden. And it was never given to Kurt. And it's a very tragic letter. And it says, respond, in essence. And that never happens. I show Kurt that letter in 2008. So over the years, Kurt eventually learned where the brother was. There was some phone calls, some letter writing. A relationship absolutely was developed, not the sibling relationship we might think, but a relationship of kind, such that eventually in the late 70s, they did get together.
Did the German brother who stayed, did he adopt any of the Nazi ideology?
No. One of the many tragedies, I came into this book with certain skepticism or concerns about that brother, and I was unbelievably wrong. And there were very powerful things that happened when I went to Germany and France and interviewed the family members there. And what I learned in part was that Heinz, after learning that his family had lived next to him for 10 years, it's on his birthday, becomes hysterical, and he fashions an agreement. And the agreement is that they're going to go to the Nazi headquarters to find out what happened. And they go there. He doesn't speak. His Christian grandfather does. What happened to those Jews? And the response is, if you want to go there, we'll tell you there where they are, and you can go there yourselves. Well, that ended the conversation. But the other part of the agreement was, and it's so tragic, was that he was forced to join the Hitler Youth Corps the next day after his birthday, because now he had to protect his identity, because somebody had told him about his family, and the parents, the grandparents, were now concerned. Well, if this person knows,
because he's half Jewish after all.
Well, by law in Germany, because the mother was a Jew, he's a Jew. And he is now in jeopardy, and the grandparents were now in jeopardy, and so he now has to live this life.
So he cloaks his identity in the pretense of being a Heil Hitler saluting Hitler Youth member.
Absolutely.
How old is he?
He's 13 at that time.
My goodness. And he realized the severity of the truth, what it would mean even to a 13-year-old.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was very, very clear. This is 1943. This is not 1933. This is, by then, we have the mass extermination of the Jews. The city's bombed out. He knows what the ramifications are.
Because you're right. In 33, nobody could believe.
Absolutely.
They just said, you're exaggerating.
Absolutely.
There's no systematic means by which a government is exterminating its population.
You couldn't even think that something like that could happen. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm talking with Steve Richards. His fascinating book is called Sitting on Top of the World. I want to hear what that title means, and more of our conversation coming up in just a moment. By the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, if you find this kind of an intriguing topic he's writing about, you can call us and you can ask him a question directly if you'd like as well at 312-981-7200. We're also going to do a quick contest here. So our last contest on the Bill Mahler Show, that number is 312-591-7000. Let's keep the two lines separate. We've given away, I don't know, $150 worth of free stuff today. So say the right thing, and you could be the winner of a $25 gift certificate, which you can use at any of Chicago's six Paisano pizza and pasta spots, the place that Oprah loves. Again, the contest line is 312-591-7000. We'll take the second caller, Dan. My guest for a few more minutes is Steve Richards. His book is called Sitting on Top of the World. It's about these brothers, their improbable, impossible story of growing up completely separate, even though they were next door to each other for 10 years. But one was a Jew, and the other forced to join the Hitler Youth, raised in the Protestant faith, and how they lived their separate lives and came together several decades later. So what does the title mean, Steve?
I'm a trial attorney in Chicago, and I had left the Daily Center after we had opened up Kurt's adoption file, and we were talking about his adoption, and he was telling me what happened. Old man Pritzker, the original Pritzker, was the adoption attorney. And I said, do you remember it? And he told me many of the things. And I asked him what happened. And his father, his adoptive father, had hired the announcers for the Cubs, a very remarkable man, inventor of radio jingles, Mommy Dear, I Want to Learn About a Cookie. Very interesting, fascinating people. And his father also had hired Studs Terkel for his first radio job in Chicago. And Studs had given Kurt a record. And I said, well, what did you listen to? He said, well, I listened to some music that Kurt had given me. And I, well, what was it? And he wouldn't tell me. And I kept pushing him. And I looked at him, and he started to cry. And I said, what was the name of the music? And he said, it was Sitting on Top of the World.
I'm sitting on top of the
and
world.
And the meaning of that in 1947, when you read those lyrics, many decades later, you know, he was sitting on top of the world.
And what could have otherwise happened to his life?
Yeah.
The chances were a few years later that he would not have survived.
There's no doubt. There's absolutely no doubt. When he was transferred from the concentration camp to the safe house, 8 children did not go. All of those children were murdered. One child left the safe house to go back to the camp because he needed to be with his family. That child was also murdered.
Did you talk to Studs Terkel in the research you did?
Yes, I did, just before he passed away. And it was a terrific, it was a real honor.
What was the information he gave you?
He gave the eulogy for Kurt's adoptive father and provided more of a background because he knew very little about the intimate parts of the story. He knew that Kurt had been adopted. Paul Harvey was much more of an intimate and had written a number of articles about the story. So Paul Harvey was able to add certain other things to it that Studs didn't. But Studs, by virtue of doing the memorial after he passed away, I think was very important.
Steve, put on a headset here because we have Mindy who has a question she'd like to ask. Mindy, you're on WGN with Steve. Go ahead if you've got a question for him.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I've got a question. You know, given the nature of the subject matter of your book, as you were spending all those hours researching, you must have come across many things that were startling and shocking. But I'm curious, with your background in it that you accumulated over a period of time, was there anything or a couple things that you actually found most surprising?
That I found most surprising?
Watch the fan there, Steve.
I'm sorry. I think it was the bravery of Kurt. I like to think of him, and I put it in a very simple way. He's an ordinary guy who did an extraordinary thing by being an ordinary guy. I used to think, you know, you're a Pulitzer Prize winner. You find the cure for cancer. These are really remarkable people. And what he did was he went through what he went through. He raised a family. He got a job. And he's just a regular guy. And that surprised me. It may not seem like that, but to me it was a real surprise.
Yeah.
He's not burdened in the way that I would expect people to have gone through these terrible experiences to be burdened.
Mindy, thank you for the call.
Well, thank you, and thanks for writing the book, Steve.
Thank you.
Yeah, especially bravery when you consider he, as a child, had to display the kind of bravery that most adults never have to do.
It's unimaginable for me, for this little kid to go through what he went through, went on these two ships to end up in Bermuda, then to the United States, going to two foster homes, to deal with what he had to deal with, not being able to speak the language. It's very... not an unusual experience. That's the immigrant story to some extent, right? Maybe not with all the tragedy associated with it, but remarkable nonetheless.
Yeah. Well, most cases, at least in the immigrant story, you probably know who your family is.
Correct.
And you don't have to fear for your life.
Correct.
Steve, you are donating the money from the sales of this book. Tell me about that.
I decided at the get-go that I would not take any of the profits from this book, that they're all going to be donated to a place called Camp de Gurs, a memorial that exists there. This is the concentration camp that Kurt and his family ended up in, and it's going to be donated in the name of the brothers. I felt at some level, I'm not a member of the family, I have a friendship with them, but I did not think it was appropriate for me to financially gain from this, and I think I've gained much, much more than any money that I could get from this book. It's been a rewarding experience.
What is that money doing?
It's going to go to help build something that is better than what they have right now. It's not that significant. There's about 27 camps in that general area that had been built as a result of the Spanish Civil War and sort of lay in disrepair until the Nazis found them and ultimately became a camp system for the Jews. So I hopefully it will acknowledge these two brothers and help to acknowledge the worst of those camps in southwestern France.
I salute you, Steve Richards. Fine job. And an excellent book, and I wholeheartedly endorse it, and I recommend you look for it in all the usual spots, from Amazon on down to your local bookstore. Sitting on Top of the World by Steve Richards, who's been my guest these past 25 or so minutes. Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.